Why, hello, and welcome again to the New York Public Health Now podcast. This is where we talk about the why so you can decide what to do. Hello, I'm Dr. Jim McDonald, Commissioner of the New York State Department of Health, coming to you again from the 14th floor of Corning Tower overlooking Empire State Plaza here in downtown Albany. And, you know, it's stunning. Although Albany has 182 sunny days a year, every day we record a podcast, it is sunny. So I'm not implying that there's anything we do when we record a podcast that affects the weather, but I just love the sunny weather we're having. Today we're talking to Dr. Sharon Stancliffe, Associate Medical Director of the Harm Reduction and Healthcare at the New York State Department of Health AIDS Institute, and Emily Payne, an epidemiologist at our AIDS Institute. So it's great to have Dr. Stancliffe and Emily. You're both joining us from Zoom today. I know you've been busy. A lot of people are asking about this study in particular. I think it's important we talk about this. And it's great that Zoom exists so we can have this conversation. So first, let me say hello to our co-host, Joanne Morn, Executive Deputy Commissioner here at the New York State Department of Health. Joanne, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Commissioner. I am so looking forward to our conversation with Dr. Stancliffe and Emily.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation as well. So Dr. Stancliffe has served as the Associate Medical Director of Harm Reduction in Healthcare, AIDS Institute, since 2018. Before joining the New York State Department of Health, she was the medical director of the Harm Reduction Coalition for 13 years and also served as medical director of the Harlem East Life Plan, an addiction treatment facility that offers addiction medicine, general medicine, and mental health services. She received her medical degree from the University of California, Davis School of Medicine.
And Emily Payne, an epidemiologist and a program evaluator at the Health Department's AIDS Institute, where Emily's work focuses on programs serving people who use drugs, including public safety and naloxone administration, and the New York State Department of Health facilitated drug checking programs. Before joining the New York State Department of Health in 2021, Emily worked as an epidemiologist at both the state and local levels in Colorado. She has a Master of Science in Public Health from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
So we've invited Dr. Stancliffe and Emily Payne to speak with us today about a groundbreaking study the New York State Department of Health conducted in collaboration with the New York State Police. It determined the effectiveness of a 4-milligram versus an 8-milligram dose of naloxone.
That's right. The study was actually published in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that was back on February 8th and has received a great deal of national and international attention.
So welcome, Sharon and Emily, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting us. I'm excited to be here and very happy about this study.
Yes, happy to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Why don't we just start off with Dr. Stancliffe? You know, I did quite an introduction there, but do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I wanted to say a little bit about how I came to be in public health. I came to New York as a new family medicine doctor in 1990 and suddenly had a panel full of patients, many of whom were dying of AIDS and others had it earlier. So I decided to take a trip to the local needle exchange just before it became legal and realized there's a whole other world out here. I kept going to the needle exchange. I did a fellowship with the AIDS Institute, HIV Clinical Scholars Program, and actually worked with the AIDS Institute for a while and then left. And now I'm back after 13 years away.
And we're glad to have you back, Dr. Stancliffe. Emily, just to tell me a little bit about yourself as well, please.
For sure. So I graduated my master's in public health, focused in epidemiology and maternal child health from Johns Hopkins in 2017. After that, I moved to Denver, Colorado, where I did an applied epidemiology fellowship with the state health department, focused on chronic disease and maternal child health. And then after that, I moved to the local level in Colorado, where I worked as a population health epidemiologist until COVID hit. And then I became the COVID-19 surveillance lead for Boulder County during the first year and a half of the response. And in June of 2021, I moved back to New York to be closer to family and took on my current role at the department.
You know, the background that both of you have shared is pretty incredible. I'm sure people would like to know, too. So what about the work that you're doing here in the Department of Health on a daily basis? Can you talk about that?
I work primarily with our Office of Drug User Health here, and I bring a clinical perspective to many areas related to drug use and preventing harm, such as naloxone, syringe access, treatment of opioid use disorder. I get to educate some of my colleagues. And I also get to work on policy, which I think is key to what I love to do. And finally, I still treat patients for opioid use disorder in a federally qualified healthcare clinic once a week.
I work in the Office of Program Evaluation and Research, but like Dr. Stancliffe, most, if not all, of my work is with the Office of Drug User Health, too. I specialize in all things data. I work with programs to help them collect, analyze, and use the data they have to improve their programs and also to increase their impact. And two of the major projects I work on include law enforcement naloxone program and the New York State drug checking programs.
Yeah, thank you, Emily. That's great. So, Dr. Shancliffe, overdose fatalities continue to be a major public health crisis. You know, in 2022, for example, about 5,300 New Yorkers died from an opiate-related overdose, up from 4,200 in 2020. So just a two-year difference, but quite a jump there. Can you take a step back and describe opiate use disorder? Let's just talk about the disease for just a moment.
Right. So anyone who takes opioids repeatedly throughout a number of days will become dependent on opioids. And most, they might have a little trouble withdrawing, but most will go on with their lives. Some people, after they get through the rigors of withdrawal, just never feel right without some opioids on board. We call it an opioid use disorder for that reason, and there's a lot of theories about it. But now we have two long-acting legal medications, buprenorphine and methadone, that we can give people on a daily basis, and we're getting more easy access to them as fast as we can, I think. So people that take these medicines can just go on with their lives and have it just be one small piece of their life. And I want to remind people that opioid use isn't just about getting high for most of these people. Eventually, it becomes a huge chore. Some people continue to want to have themselves feel different, so they continue to take other drugs, which I understand. But others just go on with their lives and don't take any other mind-altering substances. But also, not everybody who dies of an overdose has opioid use disorder. There's a myriad of other ways that people come into contact with opioids and have these horrible outcomes, which I've seen too many of in my 30 years in New York.
You know, you remind me that sometimes people do die from an opioid without opioid use disorder. That first dose can be your last dose experience. You know, and I think that's something where we've seen this happen, right? Where someone thinks they're trying a prescription oxycodone. It looks just like prescription oxycodone, and it has fentanyl in it. And so that happens as well, where people literally first dose is your last dose as well.
Exactly.
So Dr. Shancliffe, let's talk a little bit more about harm reduction as an important strategy to keep people who use drugs alive until they're ready for treatment. You know, so we talk about that, but what is naloxone and why is that a critical harm reduction tool?
Well, naloxone is a pretty old medication that will completely block the effects of most, if not all, opioids in the body. The chief effect that we're trying to block is the respiratory depression. We want people to be breathing. It's a very simple medication. If people haven't taken an opioid, nothing will happen to them. And we now have intranasal formulations, so anyone can use them with the minimal amount of training. But I'd just like to go back to the beginning of the question. I want to keep people alive whether or not they're ever ready for treatment. And I think it's important to realize that people that are actively using drugs come up with brilliant ideas. In fact, the idea of putting naloxone out in the hands of the community was created by people that were using drugs, as was syringe access.
So Dr. Stancliffe, Emily, you're both among the authors of the groundbreaking study that compares the effectiveness of administering an 8 milligram versus the 4 milligram intranasal dose of naloxone that people use when responding to a suspected opioid overdose. Can you tell us how and why the study was started?
Let me turn it over to Emily after a moment, but this is actually the second study that we have done that's similar. Back when we had a sort of jerry-rigged 2 milligram intranasal formulation, and then the 4 milligram was approved by the FDA, many of us, including myself, were like, maybe that's too high a dose. So we started by going to the police and having a comparison there done. I was happy that it turned out that it didn't cause a whole lot more withdrawal to switch to the FDA-approved formulation. And Emily, you want to take over on this study?
Yes. So when the 8-milligram product was first approved back in 2021, there was a lot of concern both externally and internally among harm reduction advocates that this, again, would cause additional withdrawal symptoms among opioid-dependent people who were administered this new product. There was also a lot of concern that with the increased potency of the drug supply, particularly more synthetic opioids like fentanyl out there, that higher doses of naloxone are needed to reverse an opioid overdose. However, there wasn't a lot of quantitative data out there on this topic. So as the opioid overdose prevention program at the department provides naloxone to community organizations, including some law enforcement agencies, there was a question as to whether we would include this new product onto the order form for agencies. because we couldn't find any real-world data about the use of the 8-milligram product, we knew we had to look into it before we could offer it to our programs. And like Dr. Stancliffe mentioned, due to previous partnerships with New York State Police and our close collaboration, they were the easiest group to work with, and they were a great collaborator for the study.
So while the health department works to ensure naloxone is readily available, reaching the most vulnerable New Yorkers with the life-saving tool requires quite a bit of collaboration. Can you tell us who participated in the study?
Yeah, so collaboration was definitely critical to this field trial, both the study itself and carrying it out in the field. So New York State Police agreed to trial the 8-milligram product among three of their troops located in the Capitol and Hudson Valley regions of the state. And the other eight troops continued to receive the 4-milligram naloxone product that they had been receiving as usual. One of our co-authors was actually Sergeant Jason Christie from New York State Police. He's one of the EMS division coordinators over there. And in addition to that, we also had Dr. Michael Daly from the Albany Medical College as one of our co-authors on the study. He has an ongoing role with the New York State Police and other police and EMS agencies throughout the Capital Region. And he has experience in emergency response and pre-hospital care. So we had a really great interdisciplinary team that really made this study more powerful.
We're talking to Dr. Sharon Stancliffe and Emily Payne from the New York State Department of Health about a recent study in CDC's Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report about different doses of naloxone, 8 milligram versus 4 milligram. Does it make a difference? And, you know, Dr. Stancliffe, let me go to you first on this one. What are the results of this study? Is more always better, by the way? Like, you know, we're Americans, we're used to supersizing everything here. But did that higher dose of naloxone, the 8-milligram study, did it prove to be more effective at saving lives than the 4-milligram dose?
No, it did not. The survival was almost 100% in each group. The number of doses given, interestingly enough, was similar, the same in each group, because people had been saying, oh, since they always use two doses, we need a higher dose. But people get afraid at an overdose, and they just want to give the naloxone. They want this person to live. The difference was that we saw significantly more withdrawal symptoms among the people receiving the higher dose. Now, many people say better withdrawal than dead. I would agree with that, but there's potentially a lot of unintended consequences of that withdrawal, which could include using again really soon, being reluctant to use naloxone, and people mix drugs. So when they wake up vomiting and they're still sedated, there is the potential risk of aspiration. Why give more of something when it's going to cause more discomfort and potential harm when less works?
You know, it's funny, Dr. Stanley, if you remind me that new and improved isn't always new and isn't always improved. You talked about how in the past we use smaller doses. So 4 milligrams, at least in this study, was the dose that seemed to work better. Emily, how important is it that this study was published in the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report?
So as an epidemiologist, CDC's MMWR is the cutting edge of what's going on in public health. I read it every single week. As soon as it comes out on Thursday afternoon, I usually read it with my lunch. So to publish there was really a dream of mine, and to have it be my first author publication and to have made such an impact already has been really amazing. We knew we were the first to have real world data on this topic area. And so publishing in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report just seemed like a perfect fit for us. And also, it's considered the voice of CDC. So we hope to use CDC's reach to get the study info out through as many different avenues as possible, social media, print media, to reach other public health agencies. And obviously, that's been pretty successful so far.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It is a highly regarded journal. And I think as far as public health journals go, probably one of the most highly regarded and highly respected journals. So Dr. Stancliffe, naloxone is easy to use without medical training. What about cardiopulmonary resuscitation, you know, CPR training, chest compressions? How does that fit into saving someone who is suspected of having an overdose?
That's kind of a favorite question, because back in 2016, I led a work group on what we should be teaching at overdose prevention programs. When people die of an overdose, it is usually because they're not breathing. And so ideally, we can get the bystander or the rescuer to breathe for them. That's not always easy, and COVID has certainly complicated that in the past few years. People are really afraid to do that. But we also know that chest compressions alone may help. There may be some passive respiration that happens. Certainly all that stimulation may cause people to breathe. That's part of the process, is a sternal rub to make sure people are very much out before we give naloxone. Ideally, everybody would know full cardiopulmonary resuscitation, but there are these two options of rescue breathing alone or chest compressions alone if you can't do the both together. There's a lot that goes into what I thought was a very simple issue.
If we know someone who would benefit from treatment for an opioid use disorder, how can we help the individual get into treatment?
The Office of Addiction Services and Supports has the HOPE line, which can be reached at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. The HOPE line can connect people with resources, including treatment, harm reduction, and community supports. And Dr. Stancliffe, I'll pass it to you.
Things are very different than they were at the end of 2022. As of right now, anyone with an active DEA registration, basically we're talking about all doctors, NPs, PAs, can prescribe buprenorphine, the life-saving medication that people take on a daily basis. The AIDS Institute has training resources for people that might be new to it. Our clinical education initiative is available with multiple short trainings on the use of buprenorphine. And it might be that sometime soon we're going to have access to methadone in primary care as well, as there's a bill in Washington making its way around.
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Stancliffe, you remind me that buprenorphine, that was a big change, that you didn't have to have the quote-unquote X number. In other words, you have a DEA number as a physician, but you'd have to have a specialty DEA number to prescribe buprenorphine products. In fact, I remember I was the course director for a couple of courses offering the continuing medical education so we could train prescribers in prescribing buprenorphine, which is interesting because we don't really do that for other medications. In other words, there's a lot of medications that come to the market every year, but there isn't a requirement from the federal government to do that. Can you speak to the history of why was there this requirement for us to have that special X number designation on our DEA? And why do you think the federal government decided to remove that? Because I'm personally glad they did remove it.
I am ecstatic that they removed it. Well, I think between 1970, I think, too, when methadone was approved to treat opioid use disorder, and that was revolutionary in and of itself and a fascinating history, to 2002, that was all there was to treat opioid use disorder, aside from another medication that didn't really work very well. But I understand it was a big deal for us to make this change. It makes no sense. Everybody could prescribe all the OxyContin every day that they wanted to, and you could prescribe methadone for pain all day long if you wanted to in the primary care. But to say that we're going to use one more medication for the treatment of opioid use disorder was revolutionary. That then Senator Biden and Orrin Hatch were the people that put it through. But I think that there were just a lot of constraints that they needed to make, including limits on numbers of patients, a whole slew of things. And then as the opioid crisis evolved and frankly into more and more white people dying, and many say that the medication was first created as that evolution was happening to whiter people, people began to realize it's not that hard to prescribe. The diversion is not particularly dangerous. Of course, I don't want my medicines to be given away. And that too many people were dying. And notice it was Biden who was in office when that changed. He was one of the originators of the initial freeing up of buprenorphine. It won't change the situation overnight, because frankly, I think that 8-hour training scared providers. It sounded like you needed to make a person's whole life all better. And we just don't have the tools to do that, although I'm pretty excited about the 1115 waiver coming in.
One of the things I remember about that training was Drug Enforcement Agency might come to your office and look to see how many patients you had.
They came to mine.
Yeah, and I think that scared providers as well. And it's funny, like, you know, I talked to the DEA agents and they're like, this is the least important thing they do and the last thing they wanted to do. I think there's a lot of people who are just happy that the requirement's gone. You don't need to limit the number of patients you take care of with opiate use disorder like with most other diseases. I really can't think of any other disease where we limit the number of patients a physician can have, for example. And I think it just speaks to this issue about it's really important that we treat every disease the same, have parity, if you will. If you don't have parity, you end up creating disparities. So I think that was a really important change. So it's been a fun conversation. And like we talk about the why so we can decide what to do. So I'm going to just summarize a little bit of what our conversation was about today. We talked to Dr. Sharon Stancliffe and Emily Payne from the New York State Department of Health about a study they recently published in the Centers for Disease Control and Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, looking at naloxone, an important rescue medicine, was 8 milligrams better than 4 milligrams. Results showed it wasn't. So just because something was new and improved doesn't mean it was new and improved. And they show with the 8 milligram dose, I actually did see some more vomiting, some more people going to withdrawal, but it didn't affect survival. So at least for now, more does not appear to be better. So thank you, Dr. Stancliffe, and thank you, Emily, for joining us.
Really glad to be here and to be having people hear this information.
Yes, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
So that's going to do it for today's episode of New York Public Health Now podcast. As always, if there's a topic you would like to hear us talk about, please let us know by email at publichealthnowpodcast@health.ny.gov. Keep an eye out for our latest New York Public Health Now episode on your favorite podcast player like Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, YouTube, and Google Podcasts. Search by our podcast title, New York Public Health Now, or keyword NYSDOH. Then tap the subscribe or follow button to be notified when we release a new episode about every other week. For New York Public Health Now, I'm Dr. Jim McDonald.
I'm Joanne Morin.
I'm Dr. Sharon Stancliffe.
And I'm Emily Payne.
And thank you for listening.
New York Public Health Now is a production of New York State Department of Health's Public Affairs Group. Michael Wren is the executive producer and engineer, with additional production support provided by Sarah Snyder, Janine Babakian, Barbara Stubblebine, Alicia Biggs, Monica Pomeroy, and Kyle Kotary. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at publichealthnowpodcast@health.ny.gov.